From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the Senate is still waiting to take up the House's health care reform bill, but our contributor says she thinks all the debate is still around the margins.
Whenever you have something as complicated as health care, you're going to have winners and losers. And rather than talking about what's best for the greater good, we're still stuck in what's best for this group or that group. And that really is what makes things difficult to move forward.
Later, while the musical Sweeney Todd might be dark and even a little funny, the director of Skylight Music Theater's production says there is a weighty question at its heart.
For me, it really is a morality tale and really puts into question why does someone kill? And what triggers people to do what they do.
And we'll visit with Canadian singer-songwriter and former Racine resident Carmel Michael, who has a new album just out.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Much, if not all, of the focus in Washington, D.C. right now is on our relationship with Russia and the nature of the information President Trump shared with leading Russian diplomats. But there's a lot of other business in the works, not the least of which is the bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
The House passed its legislation last month, a bill called the American Health Care Act. It faces what most analysts say is a very uncertain future in the Senate. That body has not yet formally begun debate on ACHA. Barbara Zabawa is our regular health policy contributor. She heads the Wisconsin-based Center for Wellness Law and teaches at UWM's College of Health Sciences. She also has a brand new book out on the laws of workplace wellness programs. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, Barbara Zabawa, it is always nice to see you.
Very nice to see you, Mitch. Thanks for having me again.
Let's start with the health care debate in Washington. The Senate is still, I believe, waiting for numbers from the Congressional Budget Office before it will take up the House bill that's being labeled as Trump care now in the media. Republicans who backed the bill in the House say it should satisfy concerns about its ability to offer coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. What is your read on, knowing again that full numbers aren't out, what's your read at this point on how this bill addresses that issue?
Well, my understanding is that it would separate those with pre-existing conditions into separate pools. States would be encouraged to provide high-risk pools. Wisconsin had a high-risk pool before the Affordable Care Act. It was HRSP. And it basically pools all of those people who can't otherwise get insurance because they have conditions into the same pool, then they get coverage through those high-risk pools. And that enables those who don't have pre-existing conditions, namely people who are younger and healthier, to get insurance in a more affordable fashion because they aren't subsidizing, essentially, those with the pre-existing condition. So they can get coverage that meets their needs, which may not be as extensive as those who have pre-existing conditions.
And at the same time, there are sort of fewer mandates involved in this version than what was seen under the Affordable Care Act.
Right. So the 10 essential benefits that plans right now under the Affordable Care Act must cover if they are offered through the individual market and the small group market wouldn't be there. Plans would have more flexibility as to what benefits they could cover. And so, of course, there's been a lot of back and forth about whether people who don't need maternity benefits, for example, should be paying for maternity benefits.
Well, and that's a philosophical discussion to be had. And one of the points you have made on this show before is that we're having these philosophical questions, but there's one big question that really nobody is talking about through much of this.
Yeah, well, and that is the cost of healthcare. I mean, the cost of healthcare really is still climbing. Warren Buffett met with his group last week. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal where he was quoted as saying, you know, it's not. Tax reform isn't going to help American business move forward. We need to get a handle on the high cost of health care. Employers do, because that's what's holding them back. And it has grown now to over 17% of our gross domestic product. And so it's unsustainable in a lot of ways. However, we do have a lot of stakeholders who benefit from that large piece of the pie of our GDP, and that's what makes it so complicated in really enacting reform that's going to get at those high costs.
And so the ultimate issue is that nobody is willing to stick their neck out and say, hey, you should be the group that gets less money here.
Right. I mean, whenever you have something as complicated as healthcare, you're going to have winners and losers. And rather than talking about what's best for the greater good, we're still stuck in what's best for this group or that group. And that really is what makes things difficult to move forward.
You know, turning back for a moment to the high-risk pool idea, you know, the Speaker of the House and Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan just in the last day or so pointed to Wisconsin's high-risk pool as a success story. Can you walk us through whether that comparison is appropriate?
Yeah, well, I guess it really depends on who you ask. I mean, I know I've experienced people who were part of that high-risk pool or tried to get into that high-risk pool, and there was a waiting list. And so the people who were on that high-risk pool did have to pay quite a bit of money for coverage. But at the same time, they did have coverage. It did provide somewhat of a safety net. So it really depends on your perspective as to the success of that program. Just like it depends on your perspective of whether the Affordable Care Act has been beneficial for you or not. It depends on if you perhaps were part of that high-risk pool and now your coverage costs may have gone down and you have more coverage versus you were only interested in getting catastrophic coverage and now you can't because you have to pay for all these other benefits that you don't want or need. And so it harkens back to that other fundamental question that you and I have talked about, is health care something that every American should have as an entitlement, as a right, or is it a privilege? And as a country, we're still divided on that question.
And so you are not a political analyst, but as someone who pays close attention to this world, what would you expect would come out of this debate when it does turn to the Senate?
I think ultimately there will be some fixes to the Affordable Care Act that will be labeled Trump care because there does need to be improvements. I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but I think that there's room for improvement and that the Senate will, I hope, hear from constituents, from stakeholders in the industry. I certainly understand that there are many healthcare stakeholders, providers, and insurers who are trying to get in front of the Senate to describe what they believe needs to be done to improve the bill. And I'm hopeful that that's what will happen in the end.
So let's turn now for a minute to some pretty good news on your front. You have a brand new book out.
Yes.
It is called Rule the Rules of Workplace Wellness Programs. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was 2 years in the making.
And it's obviously a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
So for our listeners, unless they are pursuing this particular course of study, they may not be likely to go out looking for the book. But in general terms, you start the book by pointing out there has been a pretty vast hole in the information that's out there in this field. So what can you tell us in layman's terms about what has been lacking?
So workplace wellness programs, maybe a lot of your listeners are work for companies that have wellness programs in their company.
I just got an email from one like 5 minutes before he came into the studio.
Oh, well, there you go. They're pretty pervasive, pretty popular. But there's a lot of laws that are impacted with workplace wellness programs. A lot of these programs collect data. And that's one of the reasons why some employees are hesitant to participate. They don't want to give up their data to their employer, and they're not sure what's going to happen to it.
Like this is telling their employer how much they weigh or whether they've been a smoker or anything, lifestyle choices.
That's right. And so there are laws in place that offer protections for privacy, provide some guidance on how you handle data that's collected. And it's more than just data. I mean, it's also abilities to participate in, you know, exercise programs or diet programs. So my book really goes through all those laws, mostly federal laws, that impact workplace wellness programs so that those people who are designing and implementing them in the workplace have an understanding of the legal parameters of the workplace wellness program.
So as you say, these are fairly popular in the workplace. So their numbers have gone up. Their use has gone up. How new are the laws regarding these programs? And so how difficult was it for you to wrap your brain around being able to, you know, basically guide people through them?
Well, some of the laws are very old, actually, and it's just applying them to a new area, workplace wellness. Things like the Fair Labor Standards Act or workers' compensation, you know, they've been around for a very long time, but there hasn't been a lot of thought given to how those laws might apply to workplace wellness. Not a whole lot written about it either, and so my book goes into that. But some of the laws are new, like two of the main laws that are just discussed, I believe, in Chapter 4, are Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act and Americans with Disabilities Act. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that enforces those parts of those laws, came out with rules just a year ago that impact workplace wellness programs. And so those rules are also discussed. So it really is a variety of how long some of these rules have been in existence and applying those rules specifically to workplace wellness program.
Of course, the legal climate has changed, or the regulatory climate has changed a fair amount in Washington in the last few months and over the last few years. Is being able to write a book on this a little like nailing Jell-O to the wall?
Yes. Yes. I do find myself in a unique position, sort of a selfish position, hoping that the laws don't change dramatically between now and, oh, say, a couple of years, because I'd like to take a break before I have to, you know, update my book.
It would be horrible to have volume two of this come out in November.
Yes, exactly. Yes, after having spent 2 years writing the first edition.
Well, if there has been this vast hole in this knowledge out there or in this area of study, how did you get to be an expert in it?
Well, I mean, I've been interested in workplace wellness. It was something I had actually studied in Europe before I even went to graduate school. I didn't study it from the legal angle. I just thought it was interesting what the role employers play in helping employees lead healthier lives or wanting to help employees lead healthier lives. And so that's always been in the back of my mind. And then when I started my own law firm about 3 years ago, I went to a couple of conferences on wellness and quickly realized that they weren't talking about compliance issues, even though there were a couple of three lawsuits that were brought by the EEOC against companies, two companies in Wisconsin. And so it was top of mind for a lot of companies about, well, can we do this or should we do this? Are we going to get into legal trouble if we do this? And so I decided to start writing a book about it because I couldn't personally find a whole lot of resources out there. And so I thought there needs to be a resource. And so far, the feedback I've gotten is that it's a welcome resource. And as you pointed out, it isn't something you want to pick up and read at the beach. But
that's a pretty cover.
if you are at all involved with workplace wellness program design, so you might be an HR professional or an insurance broker or a health promotion specialist or an athletic trainer or a dietitian, this book might be of interest to you.
You mentioned the time you spent studying workplace wellness programs in Europe. Where were you in Europe?
I was in England, Sweden, and the Netherlands.
Well, and so in general terms, can you kind of tell us how workplace wellness is treated in those places versus, you know, compare and contrast how we approach it here?
A little bit. I mean, their laws are different. I know when I was in England, I was looking at programs that were specific to employees on the plant floor. I went to several manufacturing companies, and they had programs that were separate from they separated the people who worked in the plant versus the people who worked in the corporate. And then in Sweden, there was a lot more emphasis on organizational development, looking at the organization and the environment, the working environment. And they had laws that were very supportive of work-life balance. You know, they had an excellent family leave law even back then. You got a year of paid leave. and then in the Netherlands, it changed a little bit for me and my project. So I focus less on workplace wellness and more on public health type of things. But, you know, the laws really do, and I think my book tries to get at this point, really do shape how you approach workplace wellness. And you can use the law to design a better program, or you can be afraid of it and not use it appropriately, and then perhaps find yourself in trouble.
I wonder, not to give you more work to do, I wonder whether there's a companion volume that's targeted at employees in this paradigm.
It's an interesting question. I mean, certainly Chapter 9, which is the data privacy chapter of my book, is something that I think employees would find of interest, because again, one of the reasons why employees are hesitant to participate is because of their fear of what's going to happen to my information that I give you through my health risk assessment or my biometric screen. And Chapter 9 tries to dig into that a little bit of what does that look like out there when you start putting your information out into the, you know, internet, the web, who's getting it, what are they doing with it, and do I want to be part of that? It's quite an eye-opener, frankly. It was for me.
I feel like that is a topic for maybe our next interview down the road.
Yeah, could be.
Sounds great. Again, congratulations, and Barbara Zabawa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Barbara Zabawa heads the Center for Wellness Law. She's also a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and co-author of the new book, Rule the Rules of Workplace Wellness Programs. She's also a regular Lake Effect contributor, and you can find more of our conversations archived at WUWM.com.
That dark comedy musical from Stephen Sondheim, Sweeney Todd, opens Friday at the Skylight Music Theater. We'll speak with the director when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Pasties, meat pies, are a staple of Wisconsin's North Country cuisine. But it is safe to say that once you see the classic Stephen Sondheim musical Sweeney Todd, you will never view meat pies the same way again.
The macabre, darkly funny show about the demon barber of London's Fleet Street. The play opened on Broadway in 1979 and won 8 Tony Awards.
Skylight's production is directed by Matthew Ozawa, who joined Lake Effect Bonnie North and gives us a thumbnail sketch of what Sweeney Todd is all about.
At the very base of it, it is about a barber and a baker. Right? I mean, That's not giving anything away at all. But then when you actually look at what the story is about, it's a man named Sweeney Todd who is basically wrongfully imprisoned through the justice and political system from Judge Turpin. And upon his return to London, he decides to seek out revenge on Judge Turpin. And so what then transpires... I shouldn't reveal too much, but he creates an alliance with Mrs. Lovett in the pie shop, and the two of them together then, you know, spend the rest of the show enacting very sweet and murderous and bloody revenge. And that is, you know, the base story. But what's so interesting about it is that for me, it really is a morality tale. And really puts into question why does someone kill, and what triggers people to do what they do, and what sort of circumstances also alter people's sort of habitual personalities.
I was going to say grip on reality.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Right? They lose their grip on reality. And I think every single character in the show, at the heart of it, really is very, very human. And Sweeney, I think we're all so used to hearing about Sweeney being a serial killer, which he becomes over the course of the show. But I really see the humanity and the beauty of Sweeney prior to the show that I also have found in many, many of the other characters. And so for me, it's a very relatable piece. And I guess that is sort of a shocking thing to say, that, you know, a piece like Sweeney Todd about a serial killer is relatable, because I've never, of course,
killed anyone.
Right. Or met anyone that you know of was that way. Well, I think it's so important to find that humanity, particularly for a character like this. Otherwise, he's just a cartoon.
Exactly.
And we don't care.
Right. Right. And I think that the piece is a roller coaster ride, right? It is a sort of like a dark comedy with all of this wit and charm and, you know, rhythm, beautiful music and incredible lyrics. I mean, it just pulls you into it. And like a roller coaster, I think, because most people, I think, either enjoy or do not enjoy horror or being scared. But there's an element to the sort of fear of like walking in to, you know, a haunted house or a scary movie or even going on to a roller coaster. Like, as you're going up the roller coaster, you're feeling fear. You're feeling all of this adrenaline build up in your body. But then once you go over the top of that roller coaster and start to actually ride the ride, it becomes a most sort of exhilarating experience. And that, to me, really is experiencing Sweeney Todd. I think any trepidation that people might have about the bloodiness or the murders that happen or the horrifying acts that people commit over the course of the show, well, it's sort of almost, you know, juxtaposed or tempered with all of the comedy and the wit and the charm. So you end up, as you're going on this ride, just completely being shocked and scared, but also laughing and enjoying every minute of it. And I think that being able to laugh seconds after moments that you're horrified is what gives you that exhilarating, you know, feeling and what brings people back to this piece over and over again. And so then what I've tried to do is really tell the story and have people feel that, but also really make sure that the truths and the realities of these characters are fully fleshed so that people really do relate to the piece.
Right. And you're left at the end with, it's not that you want to be Sweeney, but you understand.
Right.
Maybe a little bit about why he took the path he did.
Exactly. You know, and I think that as I've been questioning over and over again, why does someone kill? And I'm like, is it because of mental illness? Is it because of, you know, decaying, you know, social morality? Is it because of economic disparity? Is it because of the political, you know, injustice or corruption? Or is it because of, you know, that someone is seeking freedom from, you know, injustice and loneliness? I mean, I think there's so a myriad of reasons as to why people commit these actions. And I think it behooves one, especially with a piece like this, to treat every character's journeys with the sort of questioning and the deep sort of investigation into why people are doing what they're doing. Because I also think that the piece, you know, even though it's about a serial killer, even though it is, you know, scary and hysterical and you feel all these feelings, ultimately I really feel like it speaks to our time and our day and age. And I'm hoping that people come to the show and are able to really connect to the characters and connect to the piece and see the parallel with the things that are happening in the world all around us. People are committing horrifying acts all the time around us. There's levels of injustice. There's levels of disparity. And people are driven to breaking points all the time. And I think that oftentimes we either become desensitized to it or we push it aside. And I think that it's important that within this piece that people walk out of it and are sort of, you know, awakened to sort of what's around them.
And that's something that Sondheim does so well in the course of his career. Almost all of his pieces have that dark quality.
Right.
Some more than others, Assassins, you know, particularly, but Sweeney Todd, and some less so. But there's always that thread of the complexity of being human.
Yes. And that's why I think he's such a genius.
Yeah.
Because humans are unbelievably complex. I think everyone has darkness within themselves. I think there are sort of things that people are haunted by or experiences or forms of trauma that people have gone through, or they're wanting to go right up to the edge. And through, you know, other forms of entertainment, they're able to see it in someone else's journey and not have to actually commit it themselves.
I was going to say, it's a safe way to experience that kind of interior darkness that we all have, but you don't necessarily want to act on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, let Sweeney Todd do it on stage.
Right, right, right. And let me laugh and enjoy it, and you'll be horrified by it, and then leave and, you know, go back to the safety of my home.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean. Exactly. Well, and we haven't really even talked about it. We mentioned the music. The music is so sublime in this.
It
ranges from music that is actually terrifying to the most beautiful ballads. And everything in between, funny songs, and it's somehow like he managed to grasp so many different musical threads and bring them together.
Right, right. And it's completely story-driven as well. I mean, I actually have to say that having directed many, many, many pieces, this music is actually some of the hardest around. It is unbelievably challenging to actors and singers because of its vocal demands. I mean, if you really look at the score, people's ranges are huge. I mean, he's asking, you know, ensemble members to sing in the stratosphere of like high C's, high D sharps. I mean, like so high for the women and the tenors, so low. I mean, many of the men have to sing very, very low. And even characters like the Beatle, the Judge, I mean, the extremity of the vocal range really puts quite a lot of pressure on any singer and really takes sort of superhuman singing to even do it. And then you mix into that how rhythmically complex it is and how quick the words fly by. So with characters like Joanna, Anthony, and Mrs. Lovett, the precision to like learn the music and all the rhythmic changes, but also all the words, and make sure that, you know, that the words that have an intentionality to them, and also, you know, that you're finding a through line with your character in the journey, that is unbelievably difficult with how quickly things fly by. And even the dialogue is just chock full with things that I feel I've actually never heard until we started to investigate it in our rehearsal room. So for example, even just the people's relationship to God is usually kind of passed over and ignored, or people don't really quite investigate it. But it's interesting to look at who talks about Christianity and God and why, and how does that influence their behaviors versus characters who either no longer believe in God or going on a different path. And, you know, at the very beginning, it talks about Sweeney Todd, you know, he is guided by a dark and vengeful God. And so his relationship to God and everyone else's is really key. For example, Anthony, like the fact that he is a very, you know, good Christian, he gives all this money to the beggar woman. You know, he keeps showing up and asking for money. And I think that I've seen the show so many times and never realized why he gave her so much money or what he was really driven by. But suddenly in looking at the text, it's all there. And when you start to unpack it and start to unearth it and then make sure that the actors are not, you know, glomming over it, but really stressing and finding the importance and the relevance behind every single word, the whole entire piece kind of sparkles and radiates in a way that is kind of profound and very magical.
Do you think you ever find all of the stuff that is going on in there, or is that impossible?
Gosh, I mean, like any true masterpiece, I think that I'd have to keep directing it, you know, numerous times to see it all. But I have to say, this cast is so unbelievably talented and very whip smart. And so I feel like we've been unearthing stuff left and right that I just have never, ever experienced in the show before.
So you'll do it again?
Oh, yes. And what's so funny is I think that I was scared to do Sweeney. You know, I mean, it is such a technically, besides musically and verbally being difficult, the technical challenges on the theater and on the set design and on the backstage crew, I mean, it is so difficult because it moves at lightning pace, and all of the blood effects, the lighting effects, the constantly shifting of locations, the myriad of costume quick changes, it's very demanding on the cast. And there are many scenes where Sondheim has taken many locations and layered them on one another. So you have like Anthony roaming the streets, you have, you know, Todd in the shop slicing people's throats and singing, you have Joanna in, you know, the madhouse, you have like the Beatle, you know, in the judicial system. You have like everybody in these locations all going through their own through lines, but he layers them on top of one another, and you're experiencing it all. at the same time. I mean, and getting those through lines very accurate and having people see where they're going and not be confused by one another on stage is really a challenge. And so I have to
say, it's very cinematic.
It's very cinematic. Very cinematic. And also what people expect with, like, the barber chair and what, you know, things are going to happen.
Right.
And we have a lot of tricks up our sleeves. I think people who have seen the show will still be surprised by what we're doing. But yeah, it's technically really difficult. So I was nervous. I was nervous. And I usually don't love being around horror, you know, or putting myself into a haunted house. Like, that sort of thing I don't always gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. But honestly, being in this room, it's been such joy. I mean, we're laughing all the time, even though we're, you know,
talking about really hard things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, it is one that I am so looking forward to seeing. It is one of my hands-down favorite shows. And I'm not a horror fan either. I'm not one of those people that will rent horror movies. I don't.
I don't like it.
I don't like that. But this show, there's something about this show.
There is. It's so charming.
Well, Matthew, it has been so great to catch up with you again. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we're so looking forward to seeing Sweeney Todd. Best of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again.
Matthew Ozawa directs the Skylight Music Theater production of Sweeney Todd, which opens Friday at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. He spoke with Bonnie North. The show runs through June 11th, and there's more information at WUWM.com. The song we're hearing right now is from the Broadway production. It's called The Ballad of Sweeney Todd.
What if none of their souls were saved? They went to the maker impeccably.
One more break, and then we'll talk with Carmel Michael, Canadian-American singer-songwriter, the one-time Racine resident, has a brand new album out. We'll hear some tunes from it, and she'll play in the Lake Effect Performance Studio when we return with more of Lake Effect on WUWM in just a moment.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's been 5 years since the last studio album by Carmel Michael. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter spent her high school and part of her college years in Racine, though today she lives in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia.
But she was back in Wisconsin this week for the U.S. launch party and concert for her brand new album, Daughter of a Working Man. We're hearing the title track from it now.
I could have caught you on the north side before I got my hands tied, but I didn't. No, I didn't. I could have called out for a savior.
But looks or sounds can be deceiving. This song, which opens the album, is not completely representative of how the rest of the album sounds. In fact, the album is so diverse, it would be hard to pick one track that is its defining sound. So we invited her to stop by the Lake Effect studio to share the story of the new record.
A working man. I'm just the simple daughter of a working man. Now I'm just the simple daughter of...
Carmel Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's great.
It's delightful to have you back. And I wanted to start by asking you about the first song on the new album. It's the title track. It is darker and more dissonant and maybe more layered than much of what we've heard from you before, and maybe darker and more dissonant than a lot that follows on this album. So why did you want to set the scene in this way?
Daughter of a Working Man started out as a really simple folk song, just acoustic guitar, you know. But I wanted to use it as a way to introduce the lyrical themes that are going to be on the album, but also to really mess with the idea of what folk music is, because I really think that we're in a time where we have so many tools in the studio and we can do a lot of things, and it doesn't change what the core of a song is. So there's everything from a 100-year-old pump organ on this song to a digital effect. So we kind of just took the whole spectrum of what we could use to paint color onto something that I felt was a strong core, the song itself, and then really do basically everything I dreamed of, you know? And it was incredibly fulfilling creatively to make.
Well, and it's such an interesting point, because I think a lot of us think of folk as a sound, mm-hmm. and that the sound is equal to the genre. But if I get the point you're making, it doesn't have to sound like the Kingston Trio for it to be folk.
Exactly. I mean, I think the core of folk music is that, first of all, there's a narrative element to it. And second of all, that it's about the subject matter of it at its heart is something that is about people, the lived experience, and a common people, you know, like a majority sort of. And that's what the theme of this album is, like people up against a system that's bigger than them, or up against injustice or loss or some kind of struggle, and how they react. And sort of every song takes a different angle on that same sort of setup. And Daughter of a Working Man is that moment of decision. It's a person saying, I stood on the edge of something, I looked down, you know, I could have been broken by it, but I didn't. And that the real refrain for me in the song is the repetition of I didn't. That making that choice, I think, is very powerful.
What was the catalyst for that song?
I actually started it almost a decade ago. And I wrote it during a time when there was just a lot of struggles in my personal life, including my father was really ill and dying. And it was just one of those times where you sort of decide if you're going to take the reins or if you're going to sort of stop, you know, and get buried by things. And people face far worse issues than I've had in my life and have to make that same decision. I think that it's an important moment in your life anytime you come up against something like that.
The album is really, it's a diverse album. I mean, you know, there's a lot of diversity in this first song alone, but mm-hmm. then you kind of shift gears throughout the course of the album, and it feels to me like a musician exercising her muscles in some way.
Yeah, thanks for noticing that. You know, to be honest, I've always had trouble making an album that is a specific genre, because as a writer, I explore a lot of different things. Like, I write with pop songwriters, I write with Celtic fiddlers, I write with blues guys. I've just done so much writing, and for me, the core is the songwriting, so whatever comes of it, I just really wanted to be able to create an album where the thing that connected the songs was the storyline or the theme, not the music, really. And for me, it all does, when you get to the end of the album, there is a cohesion to it. But for sure, there's a lot of different things on there. And I think that's a really interesting way to make a record.
You mentioned traditional fiddling, and that shows up. I think it's in Spirits.
Yes, the most traditional one. Yeah,
and you are from Cape Breton, where there is a lot of that fiddling mm-hmm. going on, but that is not, strictly speaking, what we normally hear from you.
That's true. I had spent a couple years doing some specific projects for Celtic Colors International Festival, which happens in Cape Breton every year. And they sort of commissioned me to work as a contemporary songwriter with some traditional fiddlers, pipers, and create new music that melded the genres, which is something that I wanted to do. It was like kind of an idea I gave the festival, and they're like, sure, go for it. So a couple of the songs from that project ended up on this album. So you see this mixture of storytelling, songwriting, and then fiddle tunes coming in. And I find that mixture very interesting. I love that sound. I think people really like it because they're used to the sort of funness of the fiddle music, but the song anchors it a bit.
If the measure of a man is the thickness of his blood, I'll sink right to the bottom like an anchor in the mud. Whether captain at the table or feeding on the crumbs, I've been waiting on the bounty of a ship that never comes.
Is there much of a crowd for more traditional singer-songwriters in Cape Breton? I kind of imagine you surrounded by people who are step dancing.
That's the thing. I mean, I am a strange Cape Bretoner in that, first of all, I don't come from Scottish heritage. My parents were what you call come-from-aways. My father was from Chicago, my mom from Montreal. I grew up on, like, Bob Dylan records. But around me was this sound, and it has influenced my writing. I mean, the narrative of like these old Scottish Irish folk ballads is very visible in my writing.
So fill my cup, boys, with spirits and good luck. Send me off, boys, with spirits and good luck.
Well, at the risk of taking that as a transition, there's a song that you brought along your guitar. And you're going to share one of the songs in the studio for us. What can you tell us about Caroline?
Caroline is a song that was inspired by something I saw while I was on tour in Western New York State a few years back. It's sort of a long story, but basically I went into a gas station there to stop and ask for directions. And I saw this poster. There was about 10 posters on the wall of missing persons. And one of them just stuck with me. Her name was Caroline. And a couple days later, I wrote this song for her. I don't really know anything about her, but something about her stayed with me.
She was born in the season when the geese go flying. Her mama was selling, her daddy was buying. She came into the world like a little bird crying. Name for her mama who was nearly dying, Caroline. Proud to a fault like her daddy was mean. Tall and thin like her mama had been. Pleased like a lover at the age of 16. Chasing those taillights down the Carter Green. She wasn't no cherry, she wasn't no dove. Wise and wicked in the ways of love. Twice under the table and once above. Never let you catch her with her boots undone, Caroline. Now she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Baby, don't the world go on. Of dawn, Blue Ridge Mountains where her mama comes from, Utah desert and the killing sun, Hollywood heat where the coppers run. Someone tell the papers what's going down. Someone write a letter to the city crown. Searchlight seeking, but she never found. Just a pretty face on a poster now. Oh, oh, Caroline. Now she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on. Yeah, she's 5 years gone. And baby, don't the world go on.
Carmel Michael in the Lake Effect Performance Studio with Caroline. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's another track on this new album, which is really, as we're talking, not long into the world. Mm-hmm. And we really ought to talk about it, that you have the first video from the album goes along with it. It's called Hold. And really, it's an anthemic little tune.
It is. You know, this song started a few years back and it sort of gained momentum, especially if you look around what's happening in our world in the last, you know, couple years. There's been a lot of changes and developments that make, sort of unfortunately, make this album or make this song more relevant than it even was the day that I wrote it. But it's about something that I think doesn't really matter what era it comes from. You know, the video is basically the lyrics of the album overlaid over archival footage of human rights protests, basically, from recently and the whole last century. And to me, it's very interesting that we keep repeating history. It's interesting that human nature allows that to happen. It's interesting that we have a short memory for things and we keep trying to do the same mistakes over and over again. And at the same time, people keep cohering into communities and fighting. And that is, to me, the most optimistic thing that you can remember is that history repeats in a negative way, but it also repeats in a positive way, and that people don't give up. We hold together. We fight for a thing. I mean, this is a powerful idea. And I hope that no matter how sort of like depressing or far apart your political ideas might be from what's being represented in the world, there's always this idea that people can come together in masses, ask for change, and elicit change.
Out of the middle of the anarchy, out of the city like a refugee, everybody's telling me to give up, give up, give up. Out of my head, finally, as close to the heart as I'll ever be, even when they're telling me to give up, give up, give up. We gotta hold.
Do you have to be at heart an optimist at some level to be able to be a songwriter?
I think that if you aren't, it can eat you up. You know, I mean, there is no shortage of deep, dark places to go and sad things to focus on in the world. And it's important that sad stories get told. It's important that injustice gets talked about. But it's also important that we, again, it goes back to this idea of choice. That we make the choice to use it as a motivator.
Everybody's telling us to give up, give up, give up. Throw their money into the streets. Give me something I can keep. Even when they're telling us to give up, give up, give up. We gotta hold. We gotta hold.
We mentioned that you live in Cape Breton. You're from Cape Breton, but there's this period in your life where you were a resident of Racine, Wisconsin, which is one of the things that brings you here today and brings you back to Wisconsin now and again. I read an interview you gave with, I think it was a Nova Scotia breakfast blog called Déjeuner, which for my money is the best name for a blog in the history of the internet. But you were talking about the election in the U.S. that's just passed. And I guess, do you have dual citizenship still?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your feeling about that American side of you that spent some formative years here as you watch this stuff play out from someplace that's fairly distantly removed from the States, even from Maine?
I feel very connected. I am, I think in my heart, because I was born and raised till the age of 14 in Canada, there is a part of me that is my home, you know. But as you say, I was here for formative years and I have a lot of my family lives here. I care about it in a way and I'm connected in a way that is more so than someone who, I mean, not only my dual citizenship, but I just care about it. I'm very connected culturally to the American voice of a songwriter and the American voice as a writer. I study American literature a lot, and a lot of my heroes are American artists. And I think you can't know or understand American literature without knowing or understanding American politics and culture. They're just intrinsically connected. I care very much, but I'm also very careful about the fact that I don't live in this country. And so my concerns and my opinions have limitations, because I don't live here. And I think that that makes me an outsider of a kind, you know, even though I am a citizen, there is a sense of outsider. And I respect that distance that I have. And I don't like to step on the toes of people who perhaps these decisions, their political ideas affect them in a different way because they're here and they live on the ground, you know. It's a complicated relationship I have with this place, to be honest. It's like someone that you kind of keep having conflict with, but keep coming back to. And there's no easy way to really describe it.
Well, I want to take us out with another track from the album. Before we wrap up, first let me say, Carmel Michael, it's always great to see you, and I hope you'll come back and see us again.
Thank you so much for these great questions. Great discussion.
What can you tell us about 1969?
1969 is one of my favorite tracks. I'm so happy that you're choosing this one. Again, really special experience in the album. It was just recorded me at the piano. I had actually never played the song on the piano before. I did two takes. Suddenly the song made sense.
This house is aching and the winter's proud. The wind is blowing our patience down. I've been counting, I've been.
And we sent it to a man named David Langstroth, and he heads up a quintet called the Rhapsody Quintet, and they arrange strings to the exact track. The way I played it, any weird thing I did, they did an amazing job, and it was always been a dream of mine to have this kind of strings arrangement done on a song, and I'm so, so pleased with what they did. It's a really special song for me.
Put a man on the moon. It don't seem right. It's you and me tonight. And I can't get to you. No, I can't get to you. And you're just across the room.
Well, it came out really well. And I'm glad we can share it with folks. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All the windows are freezing up. The air is heavy, collecting dust.
Singer-songwriter Carmel Michael was born in Canada and today lives in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. In between those, she spent her high school and some of her college years in Racine, Wisconsin.
She was back at Racine this week for the U.S. launch of her new album, Daughter of a Working Man. You can see a picture from her studio session and find a link to more about Carmel Michael and the new record at WUWM.com.
They put a man on the moon. They put a man on the moon. Oh, it does.
Carmel Michael's 1969 takes us out of the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on the show, we'll discuss urban autism research and special education in Milwaukee schools, plus focus on outdoor classrooms and a major exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and do be with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
So tell me what you want to hear, I'll give it to you. Time and place will disappear, I'll give it to you, give it to you. Tell me what you want.